and welcome to Season 7, Episode 4 of Employment Law Matters, your weekly podcast on all matters employment law related. Now, as you know, this is a number one Amazon podcast. Thank you all so much for listening. It would do wonders if you could share the links to this podcast, if you could give it a review wherever you listen to your podcast. I don't often ask for that, but I'm asking for it today. And today I am going to be talking to you about zero-hour contracts. In fact, what I'm going to be doing is reading an article to you that I wrote about 9 months ago for the members of the HR Inner Circle. It's an article on zero-hour contracts, what works and what doesn't. It appeared in the monthly magazine that all members get. You know that zero-hour contracts are double-edged swords. They can provide much-needed flexibility, but their misuse by some employers has made them a PR pariah. And they're dogged by controversy and blamed for exploiting vulnerable low-income workers. But they generate a lot of confusion, and I'm going to be trying to shed some light on zero-hour contracts and on the rights of those who work under them. So I'll be discussing what is a zero-hour contract. I'll talk a little bit about employment status generally. We'll talk about umbrella contracts. We'll talk about what legal rights do zero-hour contract staff have. And I'll talk about how to calculate holiday pay entitlement for zero-hour workers. Now, that last bit, how to calculate holiday pay entitlement, is fairly tricky. And I, in the original article that I wrote last December, I went into quite a lot of worked examples with calculations set out in the magazine. I can't reproduce that on a podcast because it's just going to be impossible to follow the arithmetic if I'm doing it by way of the spoken word. So what I've done for you is I've actually uploaded the article. If you fancy downloading it, I've uploaded the whole article for you to www.hrinnercircle.co.uk/zero. hrinnercircle.co.uk/zero. And if you go to that address, if you type it in, you'll be able to download the full, I'm reading it now, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 and a bit page article, and you'll be able to download it and see it. And it's a nice little sample of what sort of things members of the HR Inner Circle get. Right, I'm going to read the article out, literally word for word. I am going to miss bits out because it was quite a long article, and every time I miss something out, I will tell you and I'll remind you of the URL for downloading the whole article. Let's go.
Welcome to Employment Law Matters with Barrister Daniel Barnett.
What is a zero hours contract? Surprisingly, there's no universally accepted definition of a zero hours contract. It's become such an infamous term that it feels as if it should have a specific legal meaning. But instead, it's become a blanket term to cover all sorts of casual working arrangements. Often it's used inaccurately. Mislabeling affects the individuals who work under a zero hours contract. They can variously be referred to as zero hours workers, zero hour employees, or just casual or flexible workers, which often fails to reveal their correct employment status. To clear up some of this confusion, let's start with what we do know. The good news is that although there's no concrete legal definition, the essence of what makes a zero hours contract has been defined by ACAS, by the Chartered Institute of Personnel and Development, CIPD, and in Section 27A of the Employment Rights Act 1996. All three definitions make it clear that it's an agreement between an employer and an individual where there are no set minimum working hours or any certainty that work will be made available to the individual. Only the ACAS definition adds that the individual also has the right to refuse any work offered. The CIPD definition and Section 27A of the Employment Rights Act imply that a contract could still be defined as 0 hours, even if the individual can't turn work down. But Section 27A of the Employment Rights Act is clear that a 0 hours contract should not prevent individuals from working for other employees. Section 27A says that any so-called exclusivity clause for zero-hour contract workers will be void and unenforceable. The other terms of a zero-hours contract are generally left up to the employer, and they'll usually cover such standard terms as the employment status of the individual, the employer's discretion to offer work or not offer work, the method for offering and accepting or rejecting work, the terms that will apply to each assignment or job, the nature of the work required, the hours for which the work's required, the location where the work's required, an individual's entitlement to pay for each assignment, to holiday entitlement and holiday pay, and to sick pay, as well as termination provisions. But as usual, when dealing with the law on contracts, there's no requirement it has to be in writing. It can also be oral, or implied by conduct, or a mix of all three. Obviously, there has to be the statement of written particulars of employment, which is a legal minimum if somebody is an employee or worker. Now, that said, in respect of employment status, the contract terms are usually not the deciding factor. The deciding factor as to whether somebody is 0 hours or not, and whether they're a 0 hours worker or a 0 hours employee, usually comes down to the working relationship between the parties, what happens on the ground. Watershed acts exclusively for companies giving pragmatic and fair advice on complex employment law issues. It's been developing long-term client relationships for over 50 years. Watershed is looking for solicitors to join them. If you are an ambitious individual with outstanding knowledge, then visit watershed.law/contact. That's watershed.law/contact. What is employment status? The law groups staff into three main categories of employment status. It's important to know how to categorise an individual's employment status, as this dictates their legal rights and obligations. There's a legal definition of employee in section 230 of the Employment Rights Act. The definition is basically circular. It says an employee is an individual who has entered into or works under a contract of employment. And it can be express, implied, oral, or in writing. As I say, totally circular. There's a lot of case law that goes around this, but none of it's particularly conclusive. I go through some of the case law in the full article, which you'll find at www.hrinnercircle.co.uk/zero. Then there's self-employed people. In simple terms, self-employed status is the opposite to employment. In other words, there's no obligation to provide personal service, there's no control by the employer, and there's no mutuality of obligation. Also, the individual needs to be carrying out a business whereby the employer is a client. A self-employed individual doesn't have to do the work personally. They're free to send or hire someone else to do the job. That said, the case law does say the employer can put some limitations on the right to substitute without undermining employment or self-employment status. It's up to the individual how and when they work. They've got no expectation of being provided with work. They're free to turn it down when offered. Then worker status is somewhere in the middle. It's a catch-all category for individuals who are neither employed nor self-employed. And Section 230 of the Employment Rights Act defines a worker as an individual who works under a contract of employment, that's employees, or any other contract which requires the individual to personally perform any work or services for the other party. But they mustn't be a client or customer of any profession or business carried on by the individual. Now, it's a complicated definition. I talk about it in more detail in the article www.hrinnercircle.co.uk/zero. So I'm going to move on, skipping bits of the article, to talking about the employment status of 0 hours staff. The best tactic for employers who are hiring 0 hours staff, notice I'm avoiding saying employee or worker. The best tactic for employers hiring 0 hours staff is to take control and decide right from the outset how the relationship will work in practice, and then apply the employment status label that's the closest match and align the terms and conditions of the contract with this. You've got to be careful if you want your 0 hour staff to be self-employed, because if there's regularity of work, that's very difficult to achieve. Usually 0 hour staff aren't self-employed simply because it doesn't reflect reality. The employer still requires them to work regularly. Plus, most employers want the individuals they hire to swell the numbers of their existing workforce and blend in, so they retain control over where, when, how the individual carries out work. And it's up to the individual to do it, rather than a substitute. So given these circumstances, it can be an uphill struggle to convince the courts that 0 hour staff are self-employed, unless they really genuinely are. And although it didn't deal with 0 hours directly, the high-profile Supreme Court decision of Uber against Aslam, the Uber driver's case, is a good illustration of this. And again, in the full article, I talk in more detail about it, but I'll give you the bullet point summary that we can learn from Uber. First of all, courts look far beyond the wording of the contract to decide on employment status. They delve into the day-to-day mechanics of the working arrangements to paint the true picture. And two, contracts aren't even the starting point. What's written down isn't even the starting point. Given that an employer can usually dictate contractual terms, the employer writes the contract, the starting point for deciding employment status is to look at the wording of the statute to see what employment status cap fits. Employment status in 0 hour contracts usually comes down to a decision between employee and worker, with worker status generally being the preferred option for employers. The arm's length nature of the worker relationship best fits the flexible aims of 0 hour contracts and its lack of guaranteed work. In fact, this lack of guaranteed work can make it difficult for a 0 hours contract worker to convince a tribunal that they're an employee, particularly if it's reciprocated by an agreement that they can also turn down any work offered. But employers shouldn't be complacent, and it's important to heed the lessons from decisions such as Uber and another case called Auto Cleanse and Belcher. The everyday working arrangements will be what determines the employment status, not the contract. Now, if that's unpalatable, then a solution can be that the individual is employed during each assignment they take on, but not at any other time. And this allows the necessary level of control over 0 hour staff when they're working for the employer to make sure that the employer's high standards are met. That said, I'm going to move on to talk about umbrella contracts here. That said, even if the intention is that the individual is only employed while working, the practical working arrangements might lead the courts to decide they are in fact continuously employed under an overarching umbrella contract. For example, in the case of Pulse Healthcare against CareWatch Care Services, the Employment Appeal Tribunal found that there was sufficient mutuality of obligation for the 0 hour bank care workers to be employees throughout their engagement. Although the terms of the contract said the employer wasn't required to offer any work, once the core rota was fixed, the staff had to work those hours. And in practice, the work was regularly provided, and the nature of the work, it was critical care, made it unlikely that the arrangement was genuinely one requiring ad hoc hours. Now, this case highlights the risks for employers in giving 0 hour workers regular work, particularly if there's an expectation that it will be done. Establishing an umbrella contract can also allow 0 hours staff to obtain rights usually associated with fully fledged workers or employees. For example, if they've been engaged for over 2 years on their 0 hour contract, if the court implies an umbrella contract, they could have enough continuous employment to gain the right to claim unfair dismissal or a statutory redundancy payment. Now, the employment status of zero-hour staff makes a big difference to their legal rights under the various employment statutes, and that's why it's important to get employment status right. Now, again, in the magazine article, I've included a detailed list of all the different rights that accrue depending on whether somebody is a zero-hour employee or a zero-hour worker, and you can download that, or if you just want to read this article rather than hear me read it aloud, you can download it at hrinnercircle.co.uk/zero. I'm going to move now to the very tricky topic of how to calculate holiday entitlement and holiday pay. Now, this depends. When you read the article, there are lots of worked examples in there, and as I said at the outset, I'm not going to read them out because it's just too complicated to understand. Some fairly tricky maths through your ears. You've really got to look at it. So you do need to, I think if this is of interest to you, you do need to download the article, which is why I've made it available to you. So how do you calculate holiday entitlement and pay? I'll tell you more after this. WorkNest is a professional services company delivering employment law, health and safety, and HR advice. They're known for their personalised approach, providing pragmatic, commercial support, as well as being a great place to work where integrity and inclusion are valued. Visit worknest.com to find out more. Back to calculating holiday entitlement and pay. All workers, including employees, are entitled to take and be paid for a minimum of 5.6 weeks paid holiday per year. That's in the Working Time Regulations 1998. Now, there are proposals to change this. I'm talking about them, if you're an HR professional, at my forthcoming HR Secrets Tour in November, and you can find out details of which cities I'm going to be in and on which dates and what all the content is at HR Secrets Tour, hrsecretstour.com. Employers can provide more leave than 5.6 weeks, but that's pretty unusual to do so for zero-hour workers. A week's holiday is based on a worker's normal working week, for which they're entitled to, wait for it, a week's pay. And this payment should be made at the time the holiday is taken, unless it's paid in lieu of any accrued but untaken leave at the end of the engagement. So far, so straightforward. But as usual, the devil is in the detail, and it's how these rights are dealt with in practice that is the tricky bit. The problem is that the very nature of zero-hour contracts means that individuals tend to work on an irregular as-and-when basis. In other words, there's no normal working week, no normal working day. You'd need a crystal ball to define these in advance. Now, to make it simpler, historically, many employers took the approach that workers with an irregular working pattern accrue holiday entitlement of 12.07% of hours worked, which would be paid at the agreed hourly rate. But as you know, in 2022, in Harper Trust against Brazel, the Supreme Court slapped a penalty notice on this approach and said the only reliable rules on how to calculate holiday entitlement and holiday pay are set out in the strict wording of the Working Time Regulations. Just pausing a moment, this 12.07% is probably going to be reinstated next year under a proposal that's currently wending its way through the government and parliament. And again, I'm talking about that at the HR Secrets Tour, www.hrsecretstour.com. For zero-hour workers, the message contained in Harper Trust against Brazel is that holiday entitlement should not be prorated to reflect the amount worked, and those workers who have an overarching or an umbrella contract will continue to accrue holiday even when they're not actually working. Going to say that again. Workers who have an overarching or umbrella contract will continue to accrue holiday even when they're not actually working, and holiday entitlement should not be prorated to reflect the amount worked. Now, of course, many employers might want to take the risk and continue to use the 12.07% method of calculation. That's clearly unlawful, but many employers take the view that It's very low risk if they do that. And for more on Harper Trust, by the way, I did a 2-hour session on it, speaking for an hour, taking questions for an hour at the tail end of last year. I'm afraid that's not available on my website anymore, my personal website, danielbarnett.com. But don't fear, for members of the HR Inner Circle, you will get free access to it from the members area of the HR Inner Circle website. So holiday pay, how do you calculate holiday pay for part-time workers? Let's talk about accruing holiday pay first. If a zero-hour worker asks to take holiday, the first question is how much they've accrued. If they've been continuously engaged for a year or more, the answer is 5.6 weeks per year. For a worker engaged for less than a year, the working time regs say that holiday accrues at the rate of 1/12 of annual paid leave for each month of their engagement. Remember, a 0 hours worker with an umbrella contract will continue to accrue holiday during any weeks or months that they don't work. An example of that, let's take a 0 hours worker called Janet, who's been engaged for 20 weeks. Her leave year runs from her start date. The employer wants to know how much holiday Janet has accrued to date. And to do so, the employer calculates 20 weeks as a proportion of the leave year times 5.6 weeks. So Janet's entitled to take 2.15 weeks holiday. That's 5.6 weeks times 20 weeks divided by 52 weeks equals 2.15 weeks. I know I said I wasn't going to read out any of the examples, and they're available via the actual article, but that one was so simple, I thought I'd do it. Now, holiday under the working time regs is calculated in weeks, but what if the worker asks to take holiday in days or even hours? Unfortunately, neither the working time regulations nor the courts have set out how to calculate a week's leave in days or hours. I know, bonkers. Having said that, government guidance is called How to Calculate Holiday Entitlement for Workers on Different Types of Contract, you can Google it, suggests that employers calculate average days or hours worked each week based on a representative reference period of their choosing. And there's an example of that and how that works in practice in the article hrinnercircle.co.uk/zero. Turning to calculating holiday pay. As 0 hours staff generally work irregular hours, section 2224. I said too many twos there, I think. Section 224 of the Employment Rights Act 1996 applies. And this says a week's pay is calculated by working out the average weekly pay over a 52-week reference period, or if the worker hasn't been employed or engaged for 52 weeks, whatever period they've been engaged for, immediately before the holiday is taken. But the 52 weeks only includes weeks for which the worker was actually paid. Unpaid weeks are ignored, and earlier weeks instead are brought forward up to 104 weeks before the holiday in total. Now, importantly, for workers with irregular hours, all remuneration is taken into account, including any overtime payments, bonuses, or commission. And it's far too complicated to read out, but there are three worked examples, different scenarios of how this all works in practice. Examples C, D, and E in the original article from the HR Inner Circle magazine, which I've made publicly available at hrinnercircle.co.uk/zero. For further information on calculating holiday entitlement and pay, you can look at that government guidance I mentioned a moment ago, How to Calculate Holiday Entitlement for Workers on Different Types of Contract. And there's some other guidance as well, Calculating Holiday Pay for Workers Without Fixed Hours or Pay. So what are the key learning points here? First of all, just calling an arrangement 0 hours and issuing a contract labelling it as such is not conclusive. Second, be clear what you as an employer want to achieve. If it's to engage the individual on an ad hoc as required basis, then a 0 hours contract is probably appropriate. But remember that 0 hour contracts work best when their flexibility benefits both parties. Number three, be clear on employment status from the start and don't try to make it up or label it as 0 hours when in reality it's not. Be clear both on the contract and the working arrangements. That provides certainty for both parties and less risk for the employer. Number four, regularly review working arrangements to make sure the contract still reflects the reality of the working relationship and hasn't degenerated into being a sham or inaccurate over the course of months or years. And number five in particular, check the impact of any changes to the working arrangements that might impact on employment status. If the status has changed, amend the contract to reflect the new status or issue a new contract. And on that note, thank you so much for listening to this episode of Employment Law Matters. As I asked at the outset, I rarely ask this, I probably do it once a season. If you like this podcast, please do recommend it to people or give it a review, ideally a 5-star review on the Apple Podcast Store or wherever you listen. You can recommend it to people using the link go.danielbarnett.com/podcast. Next week, over the next 3 weeks actually, we're doing something a little more interesting. I did a course probably 3-4 years ago now on deconstructing Tupi. I made it available for free and there were 10 modules in the course of varying length. The whole course was about 2.5 hours. What I've done is I've split the audio of that course into 3 sections, modules 1 to 4, modules 5 to 8, and modules 9 and 10, and I'm making those available as the next 3 episodes of this podcast. So if you want to learn about Tupi, make sure you've subscribed. You're going to get 3 more episodes popping into your podcast player over the next 3 Tuesdays, all about Tupi. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Barrister Daniel Barnett. This is Employment Law Matters. Stay safe.
Any information on this podcast is for general guidance only. Always seek legal advice. Please see full terms at www.danielbarnett.co.uk/podcast-terms.